Chapter 13. Harvest, February 9, 2525. Avery lay on his belly, surrounded by ripening wheat. The green stalks were so tall and the kernel so plump that a day of blazing sun had failed to reach the ground. The clumped topsoil felt cool through his fatigues. Avery had traded his usual duty cap for a boonie, a soft, wide-brimmed hat with a strip of canvas sewn loosely around the crown. Earlier in the day, he'd woven wheat stalks into the strip, and even though the stalks were now bent and frayed, as long as Avery stayed low, he was well camouflaged. Rifle bag dragging along behind him, Avery had crawled almost 3 kilometers from his parked warthog to Harvest's reactor complex. Along the way, he'd crested a long, low rise that Lieutenant Commander Alcigny had told him was actually the buried mass driver. If she hadn't, Avery would never have known. To keep the device hidden from alien eyes, Max Jotuns had topped the rise with squares of soil and living wheat dug from other fields. All told, the crawl took Avery more than 2 hours, but he had been focused on stealth, not speed. In fact, in the last 10 minutes he hadn't moved at all. His liveliest aspect was the reflection of the rustling wheat in his gold-tinted shooter's glasses. These had been part of the cache of equipment and weapons the lieutenant commander had given to the Marines. Like the BR-55 battle rifle Avery carried in his drag bag, the glasses were a prototype, a piece of hardware fresh from an Oni research lab. Refocusing his gaze, Avery checked a comm link in the upper corner of the glasses' left lens, where a tiny HUD confirmed his exact position on Harvest, a little less than 500 meters west of the complex. Directly ahead, the field began sloping downward. Avery knew all he had to do was crawl a few more meters, and the wheat would start to thin. This would give him good line of sight to the recruit's defenses and put him in a position to execute his part of the assault he'd planned with Staff Sergeant Byrne. But the thinner cover would also give the militiamen the best chance they'd had all day to spot Avery, and he planned to stay put until he was sure of his advantage. Slowly, Avery reached between his legs, undid his rifle bag's plastic clasps, and withdrew his BR-55. After the fight aboard the freighter, Avery had spent plenty of time with the weapon at the garrison range, assessing its strengths compared to the recruit's standard-issue MA-5 assault rifle. The BR-55 shared the MA-5's bullpup design, magazine slot and breech positioned behind the trigger, but it came with an optical scope and fired larger 9.5mm semi-armor-piercing rounds. Technically, the BR-55 was a designated marksman's rifle, but it was the closest thing to a sniping weapon in Lieutenant Commander Alcigny's arsenal, and Avery knew from his work on the range that it was deadly accurate out to 900 meters, much farther than the MA-5. He had given one of Alcigny's 3 other BR-55s to Jenkins. Byrne had kept one for himself and awarded the final battle rifle to a balding, middle-aged recruit named Critchley, providing 2nd Platoon with its own marksman capability. During their last session on the range, Avery had watched Jenkins and Critchley drill nice, tight groups into 500-meter targets, and he hoped, to his own disadvantage, that they would be just as accurate in today's live-fire exercise. If only it was as simple as teaching them to shoot, Avery frowned. He removed a magazine from his black ballistic nylon assault vest and quietly slid it into his rifle. But being accurate didn't make you a killer, which is what combat was all about, killing the enemy before it killed you. Avery was sure the aliens understood that. He had the scar to prove it. But the recruits had no idea what combat was really like, and that was something he, Byrne, and Ponder knew they needed to fix ASAP. The problem was, there were too many things about the aliens the Marines didn't know, and in the end they agreed they would have to make a few basic assumptions about their enemy and their men if the militia was ever going to put up an effective resistance. First, the aliens would return with a larger and more capable force. Second, combat would be terrestrial and defensive. Given enough time, Avery was hopeful the militia could be trained to sustain a guerrilla campaign. But their third and final assumption was the time was a luxury they lacked. Avery and the others agreed the aliens would be back long before the militiamen learned anything but the basics of small unit combat. Of course, the captain and his staff sergeants told the recruits none of this. Instead, they continued to promote the falsehood of a visiting CA delegation and a possible insurrectionist attack. None of them liked lying to their men, but they calmed their consciences with the knowledge that the recruits would need to master the same basic skills of concealment, coordination, and communication if they were going to have a chance against their alien foe. Avery heard the distant buzz of electric engines. He glanced over his shoulder. Epsilon Indy now hung so low in the sky that even wearing his glasses he could only stare at the star for a few seconds before shutting his eyes in a watery wince. Avery grimaced with satisfaction. As he'd planned, any recruits patrolling the complex's western perimeter fence would have the exact same problem, and none of them were wearing glasses, which might have been an unfair advantage if Avery and Byrne weren't already outnumbered 36-1. As the buzzing engines drew close, Avery tensed and prepared to slither forward. "Keep your eyes open, expect the unexpected," he had warned his platoon. For their sake, he hoped they'd listened. But if they hadn't...
"Creeper, this is Crawler," Avery whispered into his throat mic. "Mow them down."
They would learn a valuable lesson, all the same.